Some of you are going to reserve judgment. Well, it's certainly a bizarre ending in some ways, I guess you'd say. It's a book with a lot of unexpected twists and turns. And chapter 14 begins with the six philosophers, I think they're called. And they're sort of concluding their chase with Davey, would you mind coming up and helping me out with this so I can talk to the class? It's saying the battery's low. It was up just a second ago. I think it's going to come back up. But if you could just open up the F drive once it gets out. It looks like it's on its way. It starts off talking about the optimist. The optimist had wanted to chase Sunday with hansom cabs. Who's the optimist of the party? Dr. Bull. He's definitely the optimist. So it starts out with the group wrapping up their chase, and they talk about their different impressions of Sunday. And I guess this is where, thank you, Dave. I think I can take over now. Thanks. I kind of do want this chart, so as kind of an aid. I think it's interesting to look at how each of the characters views Sunday. And Dr. Bull, the optimist, has a favorable impression of Sunday. He compares him to a balloon. He tries to explain why he likes Sunday.
Sorry, the internet.
And he says, he quotes a passage of scripture. Actually, I guess we're still lacking this, right? This is here. Oh, maybe it's in. So, we'll give it a second. So, Dr. Bull compares Sunday to a balloon, and he quotes the passage, "Why leap ye high, ye hills?" He says he loves the way, he says that's a true passage of scripture, that Sunday is like those hills that leap, and he finds that charming. The secretary's response is quite different. He compares Sunday to a mass of protoplasm. And what is it that bothers the secretary? Is that from the computer?
No.
Oh, okay. So, have we tried this before? There we go. Sign of life, thank you. No, it should just automatically appear, I think. Although it's very... Normally, I go from the beginning, and I get this just as a single... Ah, duplicate, huh? Thank you. Is that working? Oh, and extend. I think so. Well, I think we'll just move along without it. The secretary is upset because Sunday laughed at him. And he can't bear that. When they're all talking about, well, no, they're not all talking about how they met, but the secretary references how they met. And it eats the secretary up that Sunday laughed at him. And he can't forgive that. Ratcliffe Wednesday compares Sunday to a tiger. It's as if in going through the jungle. And what he finds very odd about Sunday is he says that Sunday is absent-minded. And he says a good man can be absent-minded, and we don't mind that. But for a wicked man to be absent-minded, there's something that's really wrong about that. And he says it's like a tiger. It's like going through the jungle where there are these wild animals around you. And you hope that they don't notice you, because if they do, they might eat you. And that's his impression of Sunday. Gogol says that he tries not to think about Sunday. It's like looking at the noonday sun. He doesn't do that, and he doesn't think about Sunday if he can help it. The professor says Sunday's face reminds him of a mirage. He remembers at night seeing a light in a window or a couple of different things, and at a distance they all come together and they look like a face, but then you get closer and you realize it's not a face, it's actually two or three different things. And interestingly, he says about himself, the professor says, I'm a Buddhist. Buddhism isn't a creed, it's a doubt. And he blames Sunday for making him feel this doubt. The doubt's not of a materialist, he says, but of a spiritualist. And then Syme has the most complex description of all. He describes Sunday as a kind of Janus figure. He's got the front and the back. It's as if he has two different faces. When he looks at Sunday from the back, he sees this evil being. And when he looks at Sunday from the front, he sees a good man. He remembers that first time at Leicester Square when he looked across the square and he saw the back of Sunday and he felt that evil presence, but then when he got up onto the balcony and saw him face to face, he was happy. And then when they were chasing Sunday through the streets of London, he says that when Sunday turned around and looked at them, and at the time that was described as with an evil look, that's when Sunday appeared to Syme as good. So it's this a bunch of very bizarre descriptions about Sunday. Again, Dr. Bull seeing him as a balloon, a good thing. The secretary seeing him as this protoplasm that laughed at him. Ratcliffe as an absent-minded tiger who might devour him. Gogol as the noon at the sun at midday, something not to look at. The professor seeing Sunday as a mirage. And then Syme is this bizarre Janus figure with a good front and an evil back. And why do you think Chesterton is doing this? What is he going on about? Why are these characters giving us these bizarre views of Sunday? What does this all mean? I think, and I think this is, in a way, a key to the ending. and we see it revealed more clearly in the final chapter, but even in chapter 14, we need to start thinking about Sunday as God. And the significance of these views is that these are the different ways people look at God. Again, the secretary cannot forgive Sunday for laughing at him. And some people have that anger towards God, as if God has personally offended them. And they go through life carrying that anger with them. Many people view God the way Ratcliffe does, as this dangerous thing, like a tiger in the jungle. You just want to kind of sneak through the woods without having him notice you. Because if he does notice you, look out. And, you know, I'm reading Bernal Diaz's Conquest of New Spain. Diaz was a soldier who traveled with Cortez in the conquest of the Aztec Empire and other Indians. And as they encounter Indians in the New World, invariably they find temples, they find idols, they find altars with human sacrifice occurring. And it's a reminder that in human history, it's very, very common for people to pursue paganism and to have just this view of God as this arbitrary thing that you need to appease with blood. And you hope you don't get into trouble, and you try to buy him off with, you know, maybe flowers, but maybe the life of a little boy or something. Gogol is another view of God, of people that just go through life trying not to think about him. They're trying to have fun, let's go to the party. You know, I don't even want to hear it. I don't even want to think about it. I'm not going to look into the sun at midday, and I'm not going to listen to you talk about God. The professor lays it right out there. He says, I'm a Buddhist. And Buddhism is a doubt. It's not a creed. So you get all these descriptions of Sunday that are really ways that people look at God. And then Syme's description is one that is pretty complicated. And I'll point out that people that like or dislike Chesterton have accused him of all kinds of things. And in this book especially, it brings out, in the eyes of those who love Chesterton, it brings out his best, and of those who don't like Chesterton, it brings out his worst. But one of the things that people have accused Chesterton of is impiousness. And in Syme's description of Sunday, we do see certainly a description of God which is not what we might normally think of. Although Syme's view is ultimately a very optimistic one, because he ultimately compares Sunday with the whole world. And he says, we're going through the world, and all we're seeing is the backs of things, which is the bad side of things. But one of these days, the implication is we're going to see things face to face. And it reminds me of the great C.S. Lewis book, Till We Have Faces. But
Chesterton does a good job of making sure we don't see Syme as an omniscient narrator. Several times in the book, his observations are flawed, and that's part of the plot. And I think that's helpful in this climax, because, it's probably an imperfect and pious assessment of who God is, but it's also with the clear recognition.
Right. And certainly the question of evil is a question for all of us, but the solution here of sort of combining good and evil together, it sounds Manichaean, it doesn't sound typically orthodox. Christian. But perhaps I think ultimately, you know, Chesterton is certainly a very orthodox man, so I don't think there's any question about his theology. You could debate his book, but even here, I don't think we should be too harsh. Let's just continue on and try to look at the whole picture of what he presents. So, I did like as they get to the end of chapter 14, they encounter Sunday's servants, and the servants lead them to this, I guess you could call it a palace, a wonderful resort-type place. And they're given Bibles. They're given cold pheasant and burgundy, which Syme thinks is a spanking good thing, as he says. And they put on these different costumes, as Chesterton says, disguises that do not disguise but reveal. And I like this one chapter in comparing Syme, who's appearing as Thursday, and his costume denotes the appearance of the sun and moon, because the sun and moon appeared on the fourth day, Thursday of the week. And contrasting him with the secretary, who is Monday, who is dressed to signify the appearance of light on the first day. And there's this nice contrast. If Syme had been able to see himself, he would have realized that he too seemed to be for the first time himself and no one else. For if the secretary stood for that philosopher who loves the original and formless light, Syme was a type of the poet who seeks always to make the light in special shapes, to split it up into sun and star. The philosopher may sometimes love the infinite, the poet always loves the finite. For him, the great moment is not the creation of light, but the creation of the sun and moon. So I just like that contrast between the poet and the philosopher, and the love of the infinite and the love of the finite. But then something interesting happens. They have these six thrones, and in the middle they have a seventh throne for Sunday. And we're never told why, but for some reason, the secretary is seated at Sunday's right, and Syme is seated at Sunday's left. And I wondered about that. Did anybody think about that? Why? Why was the seating done that way? There's no right or wrong answer. It's certainly something that puzzled me. I mean, it's not the order of the calendar, right? I mean, Sunday would be at the end, but of course, okay, so you want Sunday in the middle, but then they didn't go Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Sunday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. They did Monday, Sunday, Thursday. I thought that was odd. And it's something to ponder when you think about Creation Week. There is a parallel, and it's the same parallel that we just read about, because it's light, but it's light, and then it's the visible manifestations of light, which you might say rule our world, the moon. So there's a parallel between the two, and perhaps you could draw parallels for the others. But let's go on. Sunday again, in sitting down, Sunday says something very interesting. And again, especially interesting when you think of Sunday as God. He says, "We will eat and drink later," he said. "Let us remain together a little, we who have loved each other so sadly and have fought so long. I seem to remember only centuries of heroic war in which you were always heroes, epic on epic, Iliad on Iliad, and you always brothers in arms. Whether it was but recently, for time is nothing, or at the beginning of the world, I sent you out to war. I sat in the darkness where there is not any created thing, and to you I was only a voice commanding valor and an unnatural virtue. You heard the voice in the dark, and you never heard it again. The sun in heaven denied it, the earth and sky denied it, All human wisdom denied it. And when I met you in the daylight, I denied it myself. So very interesting, very poetic. Certainly, I think we can think of the Father sitting in darkness in the beginning. And we can think of the Father as a voice in the dark speaking to us and us responding to his voice. But what's very interesting and the great question that I take from this paragraph is, what does that mean in the last sentence when Sunday says, and when I met you in the daylight, I denied it myself? When has the Lord ever denied it? When he met us in the daylight might suggest what? The incarnation? But what does that mean? Did he deny it? When did Jesus ever say? Now, you might say Jesus does deny it. He spoke in parables. It isn't obvious to everybody that Jesus is Lord and King. He is veiling himself even now before the world, in a sense, right? Certainly, there will come a day when every knee shall bow, when all will see clearly. So in that sense, he's veiling himself. He's denying it after a fashion. Is that what this is referring to? Or is there something else? Yeah, it's hard to talk about it because it's sort of a poetic image. But in the quote, what Sunday's saying is, I spoke to you, I spoke my word, and you heard my voice, even though, and I'll just read it one more time. I sat in the darkness where there is not any created thing. That's interesting, right? Not any created thing, only the Creator. And to you I was only a voice commanding valor and an unnatural virtue. You heard the voice in the dark, and you never heard it again. The sun in heaven denied it, denied the voice. The earth and sky denied it. All human wisdom denied it. And when I met you in the daylight, I denied it myself. So certainly we're in deep waters here. Chesterton is talking about ultimate truths. And then Sunday also says, he says to Thursday, I saw you, I think he says, I saw you when you crossed swords with King Satan. And Wednesday, I heard you when you spoke my name in the hour without hope. Do you catch that? What does that refer to? When did Thursday cross swords with King Satan? In the duel, right? He was battling Ratcliffe, but if you remember, there was an imagery there of him battling Satan. And Sunday reveals now that, yes, you were battling Satan. It's not saying that Ratcliffe is Satan, but he's saying Satan was there in the battle. And Ratcliffe, who was Wednesday, called upon Sunday in the hour without hope. When was that? They have many chapters without hope, right? The whole book had no hope.
They'd see a glimpse of hope, and then everything would crumble. They'd find out it's the wrong guy. So we had to help them.
Right. Well, so at the climax, when they're on the beach, they were really, everyone had turned against them. Absolutely, the peasant, the colonel, when the whole world seemed to be closing in on them. Remember, Wednesday said, I still have one hope. The man in the dark room, the man who called us all to be policemen. That was Wednesday's hope when it seemed to be the hour without hope. Wednesday had not lost hope. And Sunday recognizes that here. So certainly it seems like a heavenly moment where the Father is remembering the good deeds of his children and praising them for their faithfulness. But let's look again at the reactions. Earlier we looked at the perception the characters had of Sunday. Let's look at the reactions of the characters to Sunday. So and Sunday is he's very much above them all. And yeah.
I get a kick out of the pool. It says, I understand nothing, but I'm happy. In fact, I'm going to sleep.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, Dr. Bull, unfailingly, the optimist, and here, his reaction to Sunday is one of being happy and perfectly content. Dr. Bull has no problems with Sunday. The secretary, of course, does. He's angry. He says, I can forgive God his anger, but I cannot forgive him his peace. And again, remember what his perception had been. He was mad because Sunday had laughed at him. And even now, when he has to sort of leave that behind, that petty, trivial, personal problem behind, he still can't let go of his anger. He still... And of all things that he's angry about, he can accept an angry God. He's got plenty of anger in him, and he can look around and feel plenty of anger towards you and me and everyone else, but he cannot forgive God his peace. He can't get over it. He can't let it go. Syme is grateful, but he wants to know. His reason is troubling him a bit. He wants to know why, and he wants to know what. He wants to know the answers to all these questions, but he is grateful. His reaction is essentially a reaction of gratitude towards Sunday. Thanks him for the battles that they fought. Ratcliffe finds Sunday's duality silly. He finds it silly that Sunday's leading him on this chase, and they're fighting against him, and at the same time he's their friend, and he just thinks it's silly. He doesn't get it. The professor is unhappy because he too doesn't understand. Gogol just wants to know why he was hurt so much. Gogol, yeah.
Why was I hurt so much? I wish I knew why I was hurt so much.
Says the man who didn't want to think about God, right? He didn't want to look into the sun. He went and spent his whole life trying to ignore God, and now he wants to know why he was hurt so much. So, which of these reactions is best?
We spend on the spectrum of human fallibility and weakness. But science is pretty admirable. I just need some answers. There's some things that don't add up. I'm just waiting for the answers.
Right. Yeah, he's almost as content as Bull. He feels, really 90% gratitude and 10% curiosity.
It's like the guy that says, when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask God
to do. Well, that's interesting. But so you like Syme's perspective even more than Bull's? No one's for going to sleep?
I don't care for Bull's reaction. This is heavy stuff. It's not time to go to sleep.
Okay. Bull's got all the answer he needs, right? Yeah. Yep.
Be able to go to sleep in that situation is quite an act of faith that it's all taken care of.
Right.
We don't necessarily understand it, but it's time to go to sleep.
That's right. Yeah, that's well said. And I think what is really very moving here is that it doesn't matter, seemingly, how these characters respond to Sunday. Sunday doesn't differentiate among them. They are all his children. The angry one, the content one, the puzzled one, all of them. And he doesn't seem to love any of them less because they have some personal issues, or they might not be where perhaps they should be relative to their neighbor. Certainly the reader might, you know, certainly tends to think that Simon Bull are good and on the right track and these other guys got some homework to do, but that doesn't seem to be Sunday's perspective. Sunday seems to, he certainly, here, I think the depiction of Sunday as God is a very good one. It's certainly a very transcendent one. Sunday is far above his creatures, and yet he's also very intimate and very close to them, and his love for them is very real. Well, now the accuser appears. The last chapter is called The Accuser, and who is the accuser? Gregory, our old friend Gregory. And when he appears, who is he appearing as? Who is the accuser? Satan. And in fact, he's given an introduction. I can't remember who. One of the characters quotes the beginning of the book of Job. All of the angels appearing before the Lord, and Satan was among them. And what's that? Is it Bull? There you go. He's doing all right. So, yeah. So Gregory shows up on cue and makes his accusation. And let's look at his accusation. You, he cried. You never hated because you never lived. I know what you all are. I know what you are, all of you, from first to last. You are the people in power. You are the police, the great, fat, smiling men in blue and buttons. You are the law, and you have never been broken. But is there a free soul alive that does not long to break you only because you have never been broken? We are in revolt, talk all kind of nonsense, doubtless, about this crime or that crime of the government. It is all folly. The only crime of the government is that it governs. The unpardonable sin of the supreme power is that it is supreme. I do not curse you for being cruel. I do not curse you, though I might, for being kind. I curse you for being safe. You sit in your chairs of stone and have never come down from them. You are the seven angels of heaven, and you have had no troubles. Oh, I could forgive you everything, you that rule all mankind, if I could feel for once that you had suffered for 1 hour a real agony such as I. What do you think of this as an indictment? One thing it reminded me of was Mr. Locke's sermon last week when he mentioned raising children, and I think he said the first thing that they need to understand is that they are under authority. And certainly, Gregory has a problem being under authority. And but how is this as, I mean, let's forget all the anarchy. The anarchists are good symbols of this larger spiritual warfare which goes on, but how is this as an accusation? Would this be something the devil would be proud of? Is this worthy of an accusation of Satan himself? Is that?
Yes. He's saying, I'm a victim.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And why? Why is he unjust? Why is he unjust? According to Satan, why is he unjust? Or Gregory, as Satan.
Governing the creation, his creation.
right? He's attempting to govern without what? Well, Satan is accusing God. No, Satan is accusing God of attempting to govern without suffering, and in order to suffer, you need to live without having lived. He says you haven't come down from your throne of stone, your chair of stone. And how poignant is that when you think about the incarnation? He's saying, how dare you attempt to judge me when you haven't walked in my shoes? You haven't lived. You haven't suffered. If you had suffered as I have suffered, then I would recognize your... Yes, that's right.
So, there was no question. Do you think this is an accurate accusation of what Satan would do? And I think I was thinking, yes, because Satan tried to accuse God, and Satan tried to accuse God's children, yes, all the time.
Right. And what is Sunday's response? And really, when you think about Sunday's response, it's really... I mean Syme. What is Syme's response? Because Syme's the one who speaks in answer. And when we hear Syme's response to Gregory, what we're really hearing is, in this case, Syme's answer to the book of Job and the question of suffering. So let's read this in closing. Well, almost in closing. So Syme answers, I see everything, he cried, everything that there is. Why does each thing on the earth war against each other thing? Why does each small thing in the world have to fight against the world itself? Why does a fly have to fight the whole universe? Why does a dandelion have to fight the whole universe? For the same reason that I had to be alone in the dreadful council of the days, so that each thing that obeys law may have the glory and isolation of the anarchist, so that each man fighting for order may be as brave and good a man as the dynamiter, so that the real lie of Satan may be flung back in the face of this blasphemer, so that by tears and torture we may earn the right to say to this man, you lie. No agonies can be too great to buy the right to say to this accuser, we also have suffered. So, Syme, our champion, giving this noble defense of God's people. And explaining why we suffer and really embracing it heroically. I remember when Mr. Egger preached on the book of Job, talked about, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Egger, but he talked about how one way of looking at the book of Job is vindication of God's word when God had boasted of his son Job. And Job, in suffering and remaining faithful, vindicated the Lord's words. And here, Syme's attempting to do the same thing. And I think that's it's a wonderful way of viewing the book of Job. I think Job is a book with multiple answers, but I think that's one of the key ones. But interestingly here, what happens? Syme stands up to defend, and Sunday begins to, I guess you'd say, expand, right? And ultimately he says, in a dreadful voice, have you ever suffered? And the dream ends. And then... I believe so. It says...
He had turned his eyes so as to see suddenly.
I think so, yes. Technically, you could argue that it's Syme, but I think it's intended to be Sunday. Because Sunday has the dreadful voice, and it would be out of place for Syme to be asking.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, not only does Sunday say that, but then the last thing that Syme remembers are the words, can ye drink of the cup that I drink of?
Yeah.
So just to reinforce that who's saying that. Well, I'm sorry, we've gone a little long. But we can't end without asking the question, what does it mean when he wakes up and he's walking peacefully along the road with Gregory? Well, in the interest of time, I'll say, I think that what we should take from that is that we are in a war, and Syme has gone into, you might say he's had a vision. It's called a nightmare, but it's really a vision. And it's a real battle, and Syme's a real hero. And as he's walking along the road with Gregory, what Chesterton is saying to us is that the battle is real, and Gregory's real, and the vision is to be applied. It's not merely a nightmare.
I think he's stressing to the battle for John.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think that's a good
point. We know who the victor is, but it doesn't. There are ways to go yet.
Right. So, any last words from anybody?
In the last sentence is a total mystery. There he saw the sister of the girl with blue red hair cutting lilac for breakfast with the great unconscious gravity of the world. When the world fell, life goes on.
I think Chesterton just liked girls. I hope you like the book. A great book to read would be Chesterton's Orthodoxy, where there are no fantastic figures or plot twists, but there is a lot of great humor, and there's a lot of very profound wisdom. And I'd encourage you all to watch on the Catholic channel, channel EWTN, I think is where I saw it, The Apostle of Common Sense, a half-hour show put on by the American Chesterton Society. We saw a clip with Dale Alquist, their president. He's got a lot of wisdom to bring to bear in describing Chesterton's views on life. So I encourage you guys to do that. Let's close in prayer. So we thank you for this book. We thank you for the words and the wisdom of G.K. Chesterton.